Imagine someone looks you right in the eye and they promise you $100.
Okay, that sounds pretty good.
Right.
Yeah.
You are thrilled, obviously. You might even start, mentally spending it.
You've already bought lunch in your head.
Exactly. But then the very next day, that exact same person walks up to you and says, "Well, actually, I changed my mind. I don't like you, and I am keeping the money."
Oh, wow. Yeah, that would sting.
It would. Your immediate reaction is probably this sudden flash of heat in your chest.
Right.
You feel betrayed, you feel frustrated, and you feel incredibly angry.
Naturally.
But what if I told you that getting angry in that exact moment is not just, practically useless, but it actively destroys your own psychological and spiritual future?
I mean, that is a profound paradigm shift right there.
Yeah.
And that exact scenario with the $100, that is precisely how the great masters urge us to examine our own minds.
It really is. So, welcome everyone to our deep dive today. We are embarking on an exploration of a truly monumental text in Mahayana Buddhism.
A masterwork, really.
Absolutely. We are going to examine Shantideva's Bodhisattvagrahavatara, which is widely known as the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life.
Right.
But we are looking at this very specifically through the transcriptions of oral teachings that were delivered by the esteemed Kensur Rinpo.
Yes, and these were taught between 1988 and 1994.
Exactly. And our mission for this deep dive is to understand how Chapter 6, which focuses heavily on patience, and Chapter 9, which focuses on wisdom, how they form a unified sequential technology for awakening.
It is a complete path. And to honor the gravity of these teachings, we are maintaining the reverent, analytical tone of a traditional Dharma transmission.
Right, we are sticking strictly to the profound logic of the tradition, exactly as taught by Kensur Rinpo.
We aren't adding any modern fluff or, flowery language.
No strange analogies that are in the text.
Exactly. We're just exploring how these ancient, rigorous concepts dissect our modern, everyday suffering.
And to do that, well, Kensur Rinpo starts by pulling the camera way, way back.
Way back.
Yeah. He frames our daily frustrations against a cosmic backdrop that is, honestly, it's almost terrifyingly massive.
It is.
We aren't just talking about a bad week or a stressful year here.
Yeah.
He introduces the context of eons.
Right. Because to understand why a teaching on patience and wisdom is so utterly vital, you first have to understand the Mahayana view of the universe.
Which is vast.
Incredibly vast. Kensur Rinpoche describes a cycle of existence that consists of four distinct phases.
Okay, let's break those down.
Sure. And each of these phases lasts for 20 intermediate eons.
Which is an incomprehensible amount of time.
Exactly. So first you have 20 intermediate eons of pure creation where a physical universe is slowly forming.
Just coming into being.
Right. Then there are 20 eons of abidance.
And that's where we are now, right?
Yes. This is the phase we are currently in. It's the period where sentient beings inhabit the universe, where societies form, and where very occasionally a Buddha might appear to teach the Dharma.
Which is incredibly rare.
Very rare.
And then, after abidance, comes the destruction phase.
Yes, 20 eons of gradual destruction, where the universe literally disintegrates.
Whoa.
And finally, 20 intermediate eons of pure emptiness, where absolutely nothing of that universe
Just
exists.
a void.
Right. And then the cycle of creation begins all over again.
It just endlessly repeats.
Endlessly. Beings are swept along in this mechanical recycling of universes, experiencing unimaginable suffering across countless lifetimes.
It's driven entirely by their own unexamined karma and afflicting emotions, right?
Exactly. That is the engine keeping them trapped.
It is a staggering scale to think about. I mean, it makes a ruined afternoon or a lost $100 seem microscopic.
It really puts it in perspective.
But it also highlights the crushing weight of cyclic existence. And against that massive backdrop, Kensur Rinpoche introduces the ultimate lifeline.
The only way out.
Right, bodhicitta, the awakening heart.
Yes.
This is the profound, completely unshakable motivation to achieve complete enlightenment for one single reason:
And what is that reason?
to liberate all of those beings trapped in that endless cycle.
Every single one of them.
Exactly. And he says that even if a person lacks any other positive qualities, simply generating this altruistic intention makes them worthy of veneration by humans and gods alike.
Because it is the only viable method to actually break the cycle.
Right.
The entire Mahayana path, including everything we are going to discuss about patience and wisdom, is driven completely by the engine of bodhicitta.
It all comes back to that awakening heart.
It does. But, you know, if bodhicitta is the ultimate force for liberation, we have to identify its absolute antithesis.
The opposite force.
Right. And Khyentse Rinpoche, following the teachings of Shantideva, points to it without any hesitation.
It's anger.
Anger. Hatred. It is the exact opposite of the awakening heart.
And the text doesn't just say, well, anger is a bad habit you should try to break.
No, it's much more serious than that.
It provides a terrifying metric for the destruction it causes. Khyentse Rinpoche explains that a single moment of anger, just one flash of it, can destroy the positive, constructive karma.
The merit.
Right, the merit that a practitioner has meticulously accumulated over 100 eons.
Some texts even say 1,000 eons.
1,000 eons of good work, gone in a second.
Think about that. You spend lifetimes building a foundation of generosity, of perfect ethics, of patience.
Yeah.
And a flash of anger acts exactly like a spark in a completely dry forest.
It just incinerates it.
It is the ultimate destroyer of your own future happiness.
Because of karma.
Exactly. According to the strict law of cause and effect, positive actions naturally ripen into favorable conditions and mental peace.
Right.
Anger just burns those roots to the ground.
Now, Khyentse Rinpoche does note a crucial caveat here, right?
Yes, he does.
We cannot actually see this karmic destruction with our naked eye.
Right. It's not like a bank account where you can watch the balance drop to zero.
Exactly. We rely on the conviction of the Buddhist teachings to understand that invisible devastation.
But, and this is important, what we can see is the immediate temporal destruction.
Oh, absolutely.
Just think about what happens to your own mind when you are furious.
You lose all control.
You do. You can't sleep. Your food completely loses its taste.
Yeah, you could be eating your favorite meal and it tastes like ash.
Exactly. And even if someone speaks kindly to you in that moment, what do?
You snap at them. You lash out.
Right. Anger literally turns your own mind into a prison of suffering.
Okay, let's unpack this mechanics of it, because if it's this destructive, how does it actually work?
Good question.
Anger doesn't just, you know, spontaneously materialize out of nowhere.
No, it doesn't.
It feels instantaneous to us, sure, but Rinpoche breaks it down mechanically. He says anger requires very specific conditions to arise.
Right, it's a dependent arising.
Exactly. First, our baseline desire for happiness is obstructed.
We don't get what we want.
Right. Or something we don't want is forced upon us.
Yes, that's the first condition.
Second, we identify a specific agent, which is usually a person, as the obstructor.
We blame them.
But the brilliance of Khyentse Rinpoche's explanation is identifying the actual substance that allows the anger to burn in the first place.
Because the obstructed desire and the person, those are just the conditions.
Right.
The actual fuel of anger, the core of it, is mental unhappiness.
Mental unhappiness.
Yes. Mental unhappiness is the absolute prerequisite. Without it, the anger simply cannot form.
Wow.
Khyentse Rinpoche uses a very grounded analogy here to explain this.
I love this one.
He observes that in the West, people frequently go on diets to lose physical fat.
Right. It's very common.
They recognize the excess fat as unhealthy, as a burden on the body.
So they restrict calories.
Exactly. They deliberately restrict their food intake to starve the fat.
Yeah.
In the exact same way, a Dharma practitioner must view the misery of anger as a disease.
And they have to go on a diet.
Yes. They have to actively go on a mental diet to restrict its food source.
Which is the mental unhappiness.
Precisely. You have to starve it.
It's almost like mental unhappiness is a pile of dry kindling that we've been stacking in our minds all day long.
That is a perfect way to look at it.
Like, we feel a little slighted at work, we get stuck in bad traffic, we feel unappreciated by a friend.
That's all kindling.
All kindling. And then someone cuts us off in line, or they insult us, which is the match.
Right.
And we spend all of our energy yelling at the match, completely ignoring the fact that we were the ones who spent the entire day preparing our minds to catch fire.
That is an excellent framing.
Yeah.
The match is completely useless without the kindling.
It would just fizzle out.
Exactly. If you can pacify your mental unhappiness, you effectively starve the anger. It cannot ignite.
But doing this, I mean, it requires active, vigilant, internal work.
Oh, absolutely. It's not passive at all.
Rinpoche introduces the concept of deploying a spy within our own consciousness.
An internal lookout.
Right. Just as an army sends out scouts to spot an approaching enemy before they breach the gates, the practitioner has to use the faculty of awareness as an internal spy.
And what is that spy looking for?
Its sole duty is to watch for the very first flicker of mental unhappiness.
That initial tightness in the chest.
Exactly. Or that subtle feeling of frustration when a desire gets blocked.
Because once the anger fully erupts, it is too late. The forest is already burning.
You've lost the battle.
Precisely. The sky catches the unhappiness early. And the moment it is detected, you immediately apply the antidote.
Which is reflecting on the futility of it.
Yes. You reflect on how useless the emotion actually is.
Yeah.
And this brings us back to the practical examples Rinpoche gives, like the stone and the $100.
Right, let's look at the stone example.
If someone throws a stone and it hits you on the head, it causes a physical wound.
It hurts.
That is just a fact of biology. It causes pain.
Sure.
But if you let your mind generate unhappiness and then you develop this seething anger toward the person who threw it, what is the practical result of that anger?
It doesn't do anything.
It does absolutely nothing to heal the physical wound.
It doesn't stop the bleeding.
No. All it does is add a massive, heavy layer of mental torment on top of the physical pain you are already experiencing.
You are just doubling your own suffering.
Exactly.
And worse, that anger might compel you to retaliate.
Which just creates more negative karma.
Right, which guarantees future suffering for you.
The $100 example operates on that exact same irrefutable logic.
So someone promises you the money and then spitefully revokes it.
Your desire is blocked.
Your desire is blocked. But generating anger doesn't magically force the $100 into your pocket.
No, it doesn't.
It just ensures that on top of being short $100, you are now also incredibly miserable.
From a purely logical standpoint, the mental misery is entirely useless. It serves no function.
Which naturally leads us to the overarching solution here.
Yes.
If anger is the ultimate destructive force, the ultimate internal enemy, then the ultimate constructive force has to be patience.
Absolutely. Shantideva explicitly states that there is no constructive action, no positive karma greater than patience.
But, and this is a big but, in the Mahayana tradition, patience is not just, you know, gritting your teeth, suppressing your rage, and pretending everything is fine while you boil inside.
No, that is just repression. That's not dharma.
Right. It is a highly sophisticated, multi-layered practice, and Kensur Rinpoche outlines three distinct dimensions of patience.
Let's go through.
And let's examine the first one. This is the patience of not returning harm for harm, which we can call non-retaliation.
Right.
Now, at a surface level, this just sounds like standard worldly morality, right? It's don't hit people back.
Be a good person.
Exactly. But the foundation of this practice in this tradition is actually a deep, unyielding understanding of karma, the law of cause and effect.
Yeah, and this is where the logic of the text becomes surgically precise.
How so?
Well, when someone harms you, whether they insult you, steal from you, or physically injure you, your untrained, ordinary mind immediately perceives them as the sole independent cause of your suffering.
We think they did this to me.
Right. But the Dharma reveals this is fundamentally incorrect. Rinpoche explains that the harm you are experiencing in this exact moment is merely the ripening of your own past negative actions.
It's your own karma returning to you.
Exactly. He uses the analogy of getting sick from a bad meal to explain this.
Okay, tell me about that.
If you eat lunch and end up violently ill later that afternoon, you naturally blame the food.
Of course. The food made me sick.
But from a strictly karmic perspective, the food is merely a cooperative condition.
A condition, not the cause.
Right. The substantial cause of your suffering is a destructive action you yourself committed in the past.
Wow.
If you hadn't planted that specific karmic seed, no amount of spoiled food could possibly make you suffer. You simply wouldn't experience the illness.
So the person harming you is functioning identically to the bad food.
Exactly. They're just a cooperative condition that is allowing your own past karma to finally ripen.
Because you harmed others in the past.
Yes. Therefore, you have created the absolute necessity of being harmed now.
But, I mean, this is where the intellect really rebels, doesn't it?
Oh, the ego fights this constantly.
Shantideva anticipates this exact resistance with what he calls the jaundice debate.
Yes, this is brilliant.
I think this is one of the most fascinating logical traps in the entire text.
Lay it out for us.
So Shantideva asks this. When a person contracts jaundice, they suffer immensely. It's a painful disease.
Very painful.
But they don't get furiously angry at their liver or at the excess bile or at the disease itself.
Right. You don't yell at your liver.
Exactly. Why? Because they understand the disease is inanimate. It has no conscious intention to hurt them. It's just a biological condition arising from causes.
Right. It's just biology doing what biology does.
And so Shantideva poses the trap. He says, if you don't get angry at the painful disease of jaundice because you know it is driven by conditions, why do you get angry at a person who harms you?
It's a devastating question.
And the immediate defensive response from the listener is always, well, because the person has a mind.
Right. They chose to do it.
A disease is just biology. But a person has the intention to hurt me. They wanted me to suffer.
But the Dharma counters this brilliantly.
How does it counter the intention argument?
The person who harms you is equally driven by conditions.
They aren't independent.
No. They are entirely under the control of their own afflictive emotions. Their deep-seated ignorance, their anger, their attachment.
They are essentially sick.
Yes. In the exact moment they are harming you, they lack total free will. Their afflictions arise from previous causes and conditions, just as inevitably and mechanically as bile arises in the body.
So it's a mechanical process.
Entirely.
Hmm.
If it is illogical to be angry at a physical disease, it is equally illogical to be angry at a sentient being who is violently sick with the disease of afflictive emotions.
Wow.
They are not independent sovereign agents choosing to be evil. They are literally slaves to their karma and their delusions.
No, this principle is so absolute that it was actually tested during Kensuke Rinpoche's teachings with a very raw, very real-world question from a student.
Yes, this is a very important moment in the transcripts.
The student specifically brought up the Chinese occupation of Tibet.
Right.
Now, obviously, this is a situation of systemic oppression, deep brutality, and profound worldly injustice.
Unquestionably.
The student asked if, in this extreme case, anger could be utilized as a positive, motivating force to struggle against the injustice and create social change.
A very natural question for a modern person to ask.
Absolutely. And it's crucial for us to note right here to the listener that we are impartially reporting Kensuke Rinpoche's strict traditional stance here.
Right. We are simply conveying the Dharma method exactly as it was taught in the source material. We aren't endorsing a specific political view.
We are just looking at the logic of the text.
Yeah.
And Kensuke Rinpoche's response to that student was completely uncompromising.
It was. He remained entirely anchored in the traditional Dharma view.
He didn't bend the rules for a modern political situation.
Not at all. He stated definitively that the results of anger can only be destructive and bring further unhappiness.
Even in the face of systemic occupation.
Yes. He taught that returning anger toward the oppressors would only compound the negative karma and materially worsen the situation for everyone involved.
Because if you view the oppression strictly through the lens of karma, it is understood as a reaction resulting from collective actions committed in the past.
Exactly. Therefore, the prescribed Dharma method is to remain peaceful and entirely clear-sighted.
No anger whatsoever.
None. True insight and peaceful clarity, completely devoid of anger, is presented as the only genuinely effective means to navigate the situation and ultimately regain freedom.
So in this specific Mahayana framework, anger is never, ever justified as a tool, no matter how severe the worldly injustice might be.
Never. The text does not leave any loopholes for righteous anger.
Which, I mean, that requires an immense, almost superhuman amount of internal fortitude.
It does.
Which leads us directly into the second type of patience.
Yes, voluntarily accepting suffering.
Right. If the first type is about how we react to malicious harm from other people, this second type is about how we handle the inherent difficulties of existence and the rigors of spiritual practice itself.
This is the patience of pure perseverance.
Right.
It is the willingness to endure hardships for the sake of realizing the Dharma.
But we don't start with massive hardships, right?
No. Kensuke Rinpoche advises that we must build this tolerance very gradually.
Yeah.
You cannot simply decide one morning to endure freezing temperatures in a Himalayan cave.
You just freeze and get angry.
Exactly. You start with the smallest irritations. He uses the example of an insect bite.
A mosquito.
Right. Ordinarily, an insect bite triggers immediate annoyance, scratching, and mental unhappiness.
We want to kill the bug.
We do. But if a practitioner consciously uses that specific bite as an opportunity to practice tolerance.
Just sitting with it.
Yes. Observing the physical sensation without generating any mental resistance or anger, their baseline of tolerance expands.
They build the muscle. And the ultimate realization of this, the perfection of it, is seen in the great Tibetan yogi Milarepa.
Yes, Milarepa is the classic example.
To achieve his profound realizations, Milarepa voluntarily accepted extreme physical hardships.
Unimaginable hardship.
He meditated in freezing Himalayan caves, wearing practically nothing, just a thin cotton cloth.
Right.
He survived on terrible, meager food, mostly just nettles, which famously turned his skin green.
He literally became malnourished for the Dharma.
He had no comfortable bed, no physical security, but he accepted all of this without a trace of anger, regret, or mental unhappiness.
It was purely for the sake of the spiritual path.
And Khenpo Rinpoche makes a stark comparison here, doesn't he?
He does. He points out that in the worldly sphere, soldiers will endure terrible suffering.
Right. Starvation, injury, the risk of death.
Yes. Just to conquer a worldly enemy who will eventually die naturally anyway.
It's a temporary victory.
Exactly.
Right.
But as Dharma practitioners, we are engaged in a war against a far more formidable eternal enemy.
Our own afflictive emotions.
Yes. So we must be willing to accept the necessary suffering to win that internal battle, which has eternal stakes.
And if we can endure the physical hardships, we then face the mental ones.
Right, which are often much harder.
This brings us to the third type of patience, the patience of abiding in the Dharma.
Yes, to truly grasp the nature of reality, to deeply analyze the subtle mechanics of karma, the pervasive nature of suffering, and ultimately the profound selflessness of all phenomena.
That takes work.
It requires immense intellectual and meditative stamina.
Because it's confusing.
It is. When you attempt to focus the ordinary mind on these deep, counterintuitive truths, the mind rebels.
It gets tired.
It becomes exhausted. It immediately wants to retreat to superficial, easy distractions.
Like checking your phone.
Exactly. Mm. The patience of abiding in the Dharma is the spiritual fortitude to sustain that deep, penetrating analysis without becoming discouraged, frustrated, or mentally fatigued.
So we use the first two types of patience as armor to protect our merit from anger. And we use this third type to build the intellectual stamina needed for ultimate liberation.
Precisely. It builds the foundation.
But before we get to that ultimate liberation, before we enter chapter 9, the text demands a radical, almost shocking psychological shift.
Yes, it completely upends worldly logic.
Because Shantideva doesn't just say we should calmly tolerate the person who harms us. He doesn't say just ignore them.
No.
He says we must actually venerate them. We must hold our enemies in the highest possible regard.
This is where the Mahayana path completely subverts everything we think we know.
It really does.
To the Bodhisattva, the practitioner of the awakening heart, the harmer is not an obstacle to be managed or avoided.
What are they?
The harmer is the ultimate benefactor.
Okay, I have to stop and push back on this. Because if you are listening to this right now, your alarm bells are probably ringing loudly.
It's a very challenging concept.
I understand the logic of not retaliating. I get the logic of not drinking poison to hurt someone else. But why on earth should I revere someone who is acting with pure malice towards me?
It feels wrong.
It feels dangerous. If a beggar asks me for money, they want my money, but they don't want to hurt me. An enemy is actively trying to destroy my peace, my reputation, maybe even my physical life.
Right.
Doesn't venerating them just make me a passive doormat? Why should I respect that?
It is the most natural objection in the world, and it is exactly what the debater in Shantideva's text argues.
The text anticipates this.
Fully. To unpack this, Khenpo Rinpoche uses the analogy of the necessary condition.
Okay.
Consider the perfection of generosity. To perfect generosity, you absolutely require a recipient.
Right, a beggar or someone in need.
You cannot be generous in an empty room.
True.
Similarly, to take monastic vows, you strictly require an abbot and a spiritual community. You cannot ordain yourself.
You need an external site for the practice to happen.
Precisely. Now, look at your ultimate goal as a Mahayana practitioner.
Yeah.
Buddhahood. To achieve Buddhahood, you must perfect the practice of patience. And you absolutely cannot practice patience with someone who is being kind to you.
Obviously not.
If everyone in your life treated you like a skilled, gentle doctor, constantly offering you medicine, praise, and comfort, the muscle of patience would completely atrophy.
You'd have nothing to push against.
Exactly. You strictly need a harmer. Without the enemy, the practice of patience is impossible.
And if patience is impossible,
your enlightenment is impossible. Therefore, because the harmer provides the exact, unique condition you desperately need to reach ultimate liberation, they are incredibly, profoundly kind to you.
But the intention. The debater in the text and anyone listening right now will immediately say, yes, they mechanically provide the opportunity, but they don't have the intention to help me reach enlightenment.
Right, they aren't trying to help.
They want me to suffer. I shouldn't respect them because their mind is poisoned with malice.
And Shantideva's counter-argument here is an absolute masterstroke of logic.
It's so good.
He asks the debater, do you respect and venerate the holy Dharma? Do you bow down to the ancient texts, the concepts, the teachings of the Buddha?
And the debater, of course, says yes, because the Dharma causes liberation.
Exactly. Shantideva then points out that the Holy Dharma is inanimate.
It's just a book.
A book does not possess a conscious intention to help you. The philosophical concept of emptiness does not have a mind that wishes you well.
Right.
Yet you venerate it with your whole heart because it acts as the cause of your liberation.
That's true.
If you venerate the Dharma, even though it completely lacks intention, why would you refuse to venerate the harmer who is equally essential as a cause for your liberation?
That is devastatingly logical. If the harmer acts as the anvil upon which I forge my patience, and that patience directly leads to my Buddhahood, their malicious intention is actually irrelevant to the spiritual utility they provide.
Completely irrelevant.
They are as structurally valuable to my awakening as the Dharma itself. Which leads directly into another concept, Kensur Rinpo details, that completely upends our normal hierarchy of respect.
Yes, the equal veneration of the Buddhas and ordinary, flawed, sentient beings.
This is a cornerstone of the vast Bodhisattva path, isn't it?
It is foundational. Kensur Rinpoche uses the classic analogy of a bird in flight to explain this.
Tell us about the bird.
To cross an ocean and reach its final destination, a bird absolutely requires two functioning wings.
You're right.
If it only has one wing, no matter how strong or perfect that single wing is, the bird plummets into the sea.
It can't fly.
In the exact same way, a practitioner seeking to fly to the destination of Buddhahood relies exactly half on the Buddhas and exactly half on sentient beings.
It's a true 50-50 split.
Yes.
We rely on the Buddhas, the teachings, and the realized masters to provide the map, the inspiration, and the refuge. We venerate them to build positive potential.
That's the first wing.
Right.
No.
But we rely entirely on the messy, frustrating field of sentient beings to actually walk the path.
That's the second wing. Without difficult sentient beings, there is no one to practice ethical conduct toward.
No one to test you.
There is no one to trigger your patience. There is no one to generate immense compassion for.
Right.
The massive accumulation of merit required for enlightenment is generated strictly in dependence upon ordinary, annoying, flawed sentient beings.
We need them.
We do. Since your ultimate goal is achieved equally in dependence upon both groups, Shantideva argues logically that you must hold sentient beings in the exact same high regard as you hold the perfectly enlightened Buddhas.
And to really drive home how the Buddhas themselves view our treatment of these flawed sentient beings, Kensur Rinpoche uses the analogy of the king's servant.
This is a very visceral, very powerful image.
Let's paint the picture.
Imagine an ancient absolute monarch who wields terrifying life and death power over his realm.
A total dictator.
Right. Now imagine this king has a servant or a subject whom he deeply favors and loves above all others.
His favorite person.
Yes. If you, as a regular citizen, decide to harm or insult that favored servant.
Even if the servant is physically weak and you can easily overpower them.
Right. What are the actual consequences of your action?
Well, you aren't just dealing with the servant anymore. You have just declared war on the king.
Exactly. A far-sighted person knows that the full might of the king's terrifying power stands directly behind that vulnerable servant.
So they wouldn't dare touch them.
They wouldn't dare.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, if they are wise, they will do everything possible to care for and ingratiate themselves to that servant, knowing it will delight the king.
It's political survival.
Yes. And Kensur Rinpo Kri maps this perfectly to our spiritual reality.
How does it map?
All sentient beings, from the person who aggressively cuts you off in traffic down to a tiny irritating insect, are the children or favored subjects of the Buddhas.
Every single one.
Everyone. The Buddhas view all beings with the exact same overwhelming unconditional love that a mother has for her only child.
What?
Therefore, if you harm any sentient being, you are directly harming the cherished child of the Buddhas.
And you don't just incur the gentle disappointment of the Buddhas.
No, it's much heavier than that.
Kensur Rinpoche points out that behind every sentient being stands the terrifying authority of the guardians of hell.
Right.
Harming the king's servant might get you executed in this brief temporary life, but harming a sentient being generates negative karma that guarantees rebirth in the hell realms, experiencing unimaginable suffering for eons.
That is the karmic reality. But look at the positive inverse of this.
The offering aspect.
Yes. If you want to make an offering to the Buddhas, what should you give them?
We usually think of physical things.
Right. But the greatest possible offering is not physical food or water or incense on an altar.
Because they don't need it.
The Buddhas reside in perfect bliss. They are sustained by the food of meditative stabilization. They have absolutely no need for your apples or your flowers.
So what do we give them?
Well, the Sanskrit root for the word offering means to please. What truly pleases a perfectly compassionate Buddha?
It's when you care for their children.
Exactly. It is when you care for, love, and respect all sentient beings. Delighting and serving ordinary sentient beings is the ultimate, highest offering you can make to the Buddhas.
So if we step back for a moment and look at what we've covered, we've built this incredible, impregnable armor.
We have.
We've used the internal spy to stop anger before it even starts. We've understood the mechanics of karma so we don't retaliate. We've built the immense stamina to endure hardships, and we've radically reframed our enemies as our greatest, most necessary teachers.
Right.
We have completely stabilized the mind. We stopped the bleeding.
True that.
All we've done is this enlightenment.
Far from it.
Oh.
And this is the crucial pivot of the entire text. All of this, everything we just discussed, brings us merely to the threshold of Chapter 9.
Just the doorway.
Yes. Chapter 6 on patience is entirely preparatory. Shantideva explicitly states in the very first verse of Chapter 9 that all of the previous branches,
generosity, ethics, patience,
joyous effort, and meditative concentration, all of them were taught by the Buddha solely for the purpose of wisdom.
So patience treats the symptom, but wisdom cures the actual disease.
Exactly.
Patience stops the bleeding of negative karma. It calms the mind down. But it doesn't remove the weapon that keeps stabbing us in the first place.
That is the perfect distinction. The root cause of all suffering in cyclic existence is not actually anger.
It's not.
No, anger is just a secondary, highly destructive symptom. The actual root cause is ignorance.
Ignorance.
And in this context, ignorance is very specifically defined. It is the innate grasping at true inherent existence.
Okay, we need to unpack that.
It is the fundamental hallucinated belief that things exist solidly, independently, and from their own side.
Right.
Only the wisdom realizing emptiness can act as the precise surgical tool to sever this deep root of ignorance.
And to understand how this surgical tool of wisdom actually works, Khenpo Rinpoche emphasizes that we must first understand the framework of the two truths.
This is non-negotiable.
If we don't grasp the two truths, Chapter 9 will make absolutely no sense to us.
None at all. So all knowable phenomena, without exception, can be divided into two categories. The deceptive truth, which is also commonly called the conventional truth, and the actual truth, or ultimate truth.
Let's make this really grounded for the listener. What makes a truth deceptive?
Our ordinary dualistic awareness is what perceives deceptive phenomena. Let's use the classic example of a flower.
Okay, a rose.
When you look at a rose, your eye consciousness perceives a specific shape. It perceives the color red. It sees the petals.
Right.
It appears to your ordinary mind as if that rose is just sitting there, solidly and inherently existing perfectly from its own side.
Like it's an independent object.
Exactly. It appears completely independent of your mind looking at it and independent of the soil, the water, and the seed that caused it.
It just is a rose.
That solid, independent appearance is a deceptive truth.
Because it's a lie.
It is. It functions conventionally. You can smell the rose. It has utility. You can buy it. You can give it to someone. But its mode of appearance, its apparent solidity, is a fundamental lie.
Because it is actively deceiving our senses into believing it is a solid, independent entity?
Yes.
So then what is the actual truth of the flower?
The actual truth is the ultimate reality of that flower, which is its emptiness.
Its emptiness.
To perceive the actual truth, you require an unmistaken mind.
What does that mean?
A highly refined wisdom consciousness that directly realizes that the flower completely lacks any inherent independent existence.
And this brings us right to the core of emptiness. And we must be incredibly precise here because emptiness is so often, you know, fatally misunderstood in the West.
Oh, constantly.
People think it just means nothingness, a dark void where nothing exists and nothing matters.
And Khenpo Rinpoche warns that this is the most dangerous misunderstanding possible.
It leads to nihilism.
It does. He goes to great lengths to explain the view of the Prasangika Madhyamaka.
For context, in this tradition, this is considered the highest, most refined philosophical tenet system, right?
Yes, the pinnacle of Buddhist philosophy. The Prasangika school defines emptiness strictly as non-inherent existence.
Non-inherent.
It emphatically does not mean that things do not exist at all.
Right.
The flower exists. You exist. The microphone sitting in front of you right now exists.
I have to touch it.
Exactly. But you do not exist inherently.
Okay, distinguish that.
You exist purely in dependence upon causes and conditions. You exist in dependence upon your parts. and you exist in dependence upon the mind that applies a label to those parts.
But I don't have an essence.
No, you lack any independent solid essence radiating from your own side.
Well, hold on. If Prasanika Madhyameka is the highest tenet, that implies there are lower tenets.
There are several.
And Khonsa Rinpo points out that lower Buddhist schools actually taught that things do have true inherent existence.
They did?
They taught that things exist by their own unique characteristics. So for anyone listening, this raises a glaring, obvious question.
I know exactly what you're going to ask.
If the Prasanika view of non-inherent existence is the actual ultimate truth, why on earth did the Buddha teach the lower tenets? Why did he deliberately teach something that is ultimately false?
This is where Khonsa Rinpoche deploys the magnificent analogy of the Buddha as a master physician.
Let's hear it.
A truly skilled doctor doesn't just hand the exact same incredibly potent medicine to every single patient who walks through the clinic door, regardless of their condition.
That would be malpractice.
It would. In fact, a skilled doctor might give completely contradictory advice to the exact same patient at different stages of their illness.
Okay.
Rinpoche explains that if a patient comes in with a raging, dangerous fever, the doctor will prescribe a strict cooling diet. No meat, no heavy food.
All right, to break the fever.
And give fever-reducing medicine. But later, when the fever finally breaks, the patient might be left severely weakened. They might develop a completely different imbalance, like a profound lack of vital energy.
So the treatment has to change.
Exactly. The doctor will completely reverse the prescription, now ordering the patient to eat the very meat and heavy foods he previously forbade.
Because the medicine is tailored perfectly to the capacity of the patient at that exact moment?
Precisely. If the Buddha had immediately taught the profound, incredibly subtle doctrine of non-inherent existence to early students whose minds were not intellectually or spiritually fortified by patience and immense merit, it would have been disastrous.
They wouldn't have been able to handle it.
They would have completely misunderstood it.
Mm-hmm.
They would have heard non-inherent existence and thought, oh, nothing exists at all.
It's all an illusion. None of it matters.
Exactly. They would have fallen straight into the extreme of nihilism.
And Rinpoche calls nihilism the dismantling of dependent arising, doesn't he?
Yes. That is a fatal error. If a student falls into nihilism, they think, well, if nothing truly exists, then karma doesn't exist either.
My actions don't matter.
Right. They will abandon ethical conduct, they will stop practicing generosity, and they will completely destroy their spiritual progression, ensuring immense future suffering in the lower realms.
So to prevent this fatal misunderstanding, to protect the patients,
the Buddha skillfully prescribed the lower tenets, affirming that things do inherently exist as a temporary grounding medicine.
Right.
This grounded those early students in the absolute reality of cause and effect until their minds were finally strong enough to handle the ultimate surgical procedure of emptiness.
Okay, so assuming we've built the stamina, our minds are fortified, and we are ready for the surgery, how do we actually investigate this ultimate truth?
Practically speaking.
Right. Rinpoche talks about the two selflessnesses. The selflessness of the person and the selflessness of phenomena.
Yes. And he notes that as a practical matter, it is generally much easier for a practitioner to realize the selflessness of their own person, their own self, before tackling the selflessness of all external phenomena.
We have to start with ourselves.
We have to actively, logically search for this inherently existing self that we feel so strongly when we get angry or proud.
Let's actually do that search right now. How do we apply the placement of mindfulness practically, just as Rinpoche instructed?
Rinpoche uses the mindfulness of the body and the mindfulness of feeling to systematically dismantle our assumptions. Let's start with the body.
Okay.
When you think of my body, it feels like a very solid, singular, inherently existing thing.
It just feels like me.
But if we search for it with an analytical, surgical mind, where exactly is it? Let's mentally divide the body into its parts. You look at your hand. Is the hand the body?
No, it's just a hair.
Is the foot the body?
No.
The stomach, the lungs, the blood flowing through your veins. Are any of these individual parts the body?
No. If you amputate a leg, I am still here and my body is still here. It's just altered. So the leg obviously wasn't the core body.
Exactly. If you mentally strip away every single part, bone by bone, organ by organ, muscle by muscle.
There is no hidden glowing essence called the body left over at the end.
None. We cannot find a body that exists by its own characteristic independent of those specific parts.
It's empty.
The body is just a convenient, conventional label that the mind applies to a specific arrangement of non-body parts.
That is so profound.
And Rinpoche applies this exact same rigorous dismantling logic to our feelings.
Our emotions.
Yes. We experience suffering or happiness, and we naturally grasp at those feelings as incredibly solid, real things. And we grasp at a solid self that is supposedly experiencing them.
I am sad. I'm happy.
Right. But if suffering were inherently, solidly existent from its own side, it could never, ever change.
Because it would be fixed.
It would be frozen. A person who achieves a joyous meditative state could never experience it because the solid, unchanging nature of their previous suffering would permanently block it.
Wow.
When we search for the feeling, when we analyze its causes, its fleeting nature, and the mind experiencing it, we find that the feeling only arises dependently.
It's just a temporary combination.
It is a temporary coming together of conditions. It is not an independent, self-sustaining entity.
I have to pause here. I am following the logic, but I think many people listening might feel exactly as I do right now. This is incredibly dense.
It is the deepest philosophy in the world.
Dismantling our entire perception of reality, piece by piece, looking for a self and constantly failing to find it. I mean, it's exhausting, and it is deeply counterintuitive to how we live our lives.
It fights against all of our conditioning.
What if you, the listener, are sitting here thinking, I am trying, but I just don't fully get this emptiness thing yet. It feels too subtle, or maybe I even feel internal resistance to it.
Kensuke Rinko addresses that exact feeling of overwhelm, and he does it by quoting Arideva, who is the principal disciple of the great master Nagarjuna.
Okay.
It's perhaps one of the most profoundly inspiring and honestly forgiving statements in the entire Mahayana tradition.
What does Arideva say?
Arideva says that beings with inferior merit won't even have the capacity to doubt their ordinary perception.
They just accept the illusion.
They will just blindly, comfortably accept the deceptive truth of the world. But, he says, even harboring a mere genuine skepticism about emptiness.
Just skepticism.
Just sincerely wondering, could it be true that things lack inherent existence? Is it possible that I am actually hallucinating the solidity of my enemies, my problems, and myself?
Just asking the question.
Even that tiny seed of doubt is enough to shatter samsara into pieces.
Just having the skepticism, just being open to the idea that you might be fundamentally wrong about reality, that shatters the cycle of suffering.
Yes. Rinpoche explains that even if you struggle deeply with the text, even if you don't achieve a direct, non-conceptual realization of emptiness in this lifetime, the very act of engaging joyfully with these teachings leaves an indelible imprint on your consciousness.
It changes you.
By merely trying to understand, you make the ignorance that fuels your suffering lose its absolute iron grip over you.
Wow.
That imprint of wisdom travels with your consciousness into future lives, guaranteeing that you will eventually reconnect with these exact teachings and absolutely achieve final liberation.
So you don't have to be a Buddha today.
You don't have to be a perfect enlightened master today. You just have to be a willing, joyful skeptic of your own illusions.
That is an incredibly encouraging and powerful place to land. We've traversed an immense landscape today, relying strictly on the profound insights of Kensuke Rinpoche's commentary on Shantideva.
We covered eons of ground.
Let's trace the massive journey we've taken. We started out way back in the cosmos, understanding that across incomprehensible eons of creation and destruction, the awakening heart of Bodhicitta is our only true lasting refuge.
Our only lifeline.
We dissected the actual mechanics of our ultimate enemy, anger, realizing that mental unhappiness is the dry kindling that fuels the complete destruction of our painstakingly built merit.
And we learned how to stop it.
Right. We learned to deploy our internal spy to starve that fire before it ever starts.
And from there, we explored the radical stabilizing technology of patience.
Yes.
We learned that retaliating against the ripening of our own karma is as completely illogical as screaming at a physical disease.
The jaundice debate.
Exactly. We saw how the Bodhisattva completely reframes the harmer, not as an obstacle, but as the ultimate necessary benefactor.
They are as essential for our awakening as the Buddhas themselves.
They are.
And finally, we saw how all of that patience, all of that mental stabilization and merit building is simply the necessary preparation required to finally wield the ultimate surgical tool.
Wisdom.
The realization that all phenomena, including the very self that feels so deeply wounded by the world, completely lack any inherent solid existence.
It is a complete sequential path from our most destructive worldly impulses straight to ultimate luminous liberation.
It really is the perfect map for the mind.
It is.
We've covered a staggering amount of philosophical and practical ground today. But before we go, I want to leave you with a final provocative thought to mull over on your own.
Something to take with them.
Exactly. Something that brings all of these massive cosmic and philosophical concepts right down into your daily life.
Right.
If everything you encounter, from the coworker who undermines you to the person who cuts you off in traffic to the very physical form you call your own body, if all of it lacks inherent, independent, solid existence, then what exactly are you defending when you get angry?
That is the question.
The next time you feel that familiar heat rising in your chest, that mental unhappiness rising up to fuel your frustration, I want you to pause, deploy that internal spy we talked about, and ask yourself this single penetrating question: who is angry and what is there to be angry at?